Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Doug Thomas. I represent Trojan Labor and Ace American Insurance Company in this workers' compensation appeal. The issue presented today, I think the critical component of the issue today, is may an administrative law judge, a workers' compensation administrative law judge, reserve a compulsory issue or claim for future determination when the issue was never presented to the judge in the first instance? My clients think the answer to that's no, and I think the answer to that is no for multiple reasons, but let me give you three of them right here today. First, let's establish that this is indeed, what we're talking about here today is indeed a compulsory claim. It is a compulsory claim. The case law, both Hanna versus Print Expediter, cited repeatedly in the brief, and Milco Construction, established that an injured worker must, it's compulsory, must bring a claim for future medical care at the time permanent partial disability is established.
Unless the issue is, the ALJ reserves the question, correct?
Well, and I think that is the critical issue here, but let me walk through and make sure we've got the foundation established so we can discuss that.
I apologize, please.
And I think the foundation is it's compulsory claim by case law. The administrative law judge found it was compulsory, and in fact, the Industrial Claims Appeals Office acknowledged it was compulsory. And I don't think that any party's arguing it's not here. I think factually, the administrative law judge that first determined the issue found that the injured worker had full knowledge that permanent partial disability was going to be determined. And again, the administrative law judge factually determined that the injured worker and the attorney failed to raise the issue of future medical care in any pretrial pleading, in any pleading of any kind at the hearing or any post-hearing submission, and therefore did not raise that issue and it was waived.
Thomas, can I interrupt you for
sure.
A second? I'm realizing to the bailiff, I'm not seeing time running. Is the clock on back there?
It does not appear to be on my podium either. It doesn't appear to be on in front of you either.
So. No, it's not. If I can ask the bailiff, just would you alert us when we have 5 minutes left, please? I apologize, Mr. Thomas. I'm not sure what the problem is.
That would be great. It was a perfect interruption point because then we pick up with, it seems obvious, Mr. Thomas, if the law says it's a compulsory claim, the claimant knew that that was the issue and the claimant didn't bring the issue, it's waived. And the administrative law judge found it was. The Industrial Claims Appeals Office reversed that determination, finding that this generic language, as we like to call it, contained in the original judge's order that says all issues not determined herein are reserved for future determination, save that. We think that's wrong, really for four reasons. So let's start with them. Number one is you can't reserve something that's not brought to you in the first instance.
You've said that a couple of times, Mr. Thomas, and I want to drill down on this because it's one of the issues that causes me a little bit of concern. And perhaps it's, I need you or would ask you to define for me what you say, that it wasn't brought in the first place. I gathered from the briefs that the issue was at least originally on the table. Then, it's as part of, I suppose, the dime, it was in there. You all withdrew it. There was at least some indication that the employee here was going to need future care. That at least was presented as part of the dime to the ALJ. It's not clear to me that, so what else do you have to do to present it? You say it wasn't presented at all.
There are pleadings in workers' compensation cases much the same as there would be pleadings in any district court tort case. In a tort case, there's a complaint and an answer and a counterclaim. In the workers' compensation setting, there's an application for hearing and a response. That's how the parties raise issues to a judge. In this case, my client filed the application for hearing and did not raise that issue. And the injured worker filed a response, an answer, if you will, and didn't raise that issue.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
You file these pleadings by checking off boxes on forms, as I understand it. I'm looking at the response to the application hearing filed by Mr. Lassiter. Which box would you have expected his counsel to check to raise the notion of future medical benefits?
Well, I'm not sure the exact form you're holding in your hand, but the most current form under the issues of medical benefits does have a box that says benefits after maximum medical improvement. And if you go further down the form, there's also a space for other issues, which is there for the parties to add issues for hearing, which is not contained in a box.
And the only thing on here is overcoming division IME impairment rating.
That's true. That's all the, that is all the injured worker raise.
Yet, certainly the Dimes opinion mentioned the possibility of future medical benefit needs, or medical needs, right?
Well, certainly various doctors addressed that. That's true. There was conflicting evidence on that. That's true. But it wasn't presented to the judge as an issue. You can have medical records that contain information. It doesn't mean that the issue is raised. So, yes, and keep in mind, too, that the division independent medical examiner's role is very limited, and it's limited to two things. Is the injured worker at maximum medical improvement, and is the, what's the injured worker's impairment, if any? The opinion of an independent medical examiner, a division independent medical examiner on future medical benefits has no weight whatsoever. It's the same as any other physician in the record. So I disagree that simply submitting medical records which contain some statement regarding some future medical benefits means that that's at issue. Let's start with the fundamentals. I think like any other cause of action, there are pleadings. It's not raised in the pleadings. It's not explicitly raised. It's not implicitly raised. And more importantly, the administrative law judge factually determined it wasn't raised. Those factual findings are binding on the court. The initial administrative law judge found it wasn't raised in any way, shape, or form.
Subsequent administrative law judge.
That's true. That is absolutely true.
He was reading the mind of the administrative law judge who said, well, I take it back. I shouldn't say
that. Well, he was reading the evidence in the record before him, and based on the evidence in the record before him, he found that the injured worker did not raise it. Right. It's not raised. At the beginning of the hearing, the judge asked what the issues were that he was to determine. It wasn't raised then, so it's not raised in any pretrial pleading. It's not raised by any motion. You get in front of the judge looks you in the eye, what are the issues here today? It's not raised then. You have a chance to make closing arguments. You don't address it then.
Let's assume that it would be waived and that it was mandatory and it should have been raised.
Yes.
But doesn't the Hanna case at least suggest that there will not be a waiver in the situation where there is an express reservation by the ALJ?
Now, yes.
What do you think that means? When does express means that it has to specifically mention future medical benefits?
Yes, and I think it has to be before the judge in order for him to reserve it. He has to have it in front of him and say, for whatever reason, he's not going to determine it, and he has to explicitly mention it, yes.
Where do you get that, Mr. Thomas? I mean, I understand your argument, but what's the legal support for that?
For which part?
It has to be in front of him, and then he doesn't address it for some reason, and then say it's reserved. I mean, Hanna didn't address that at all. There was no reservation whatsoever in Hanna, and says if there was, that would, you know, make a difference. Here, you know, I think you want us to really follow the ALJ, which says it was generic, it was boilerplate, it was thrown in. Now, what's our basis for saying that? How can we assume an administrative law judge put something in an order that's meaningless? And so I threw out a lot at you, but I'd be interested in your response.
Well, the ALJ, who also is in the Office of Administrative Courts that knows how things operate, found that. So it's a factual finding. But let me go a couple steps further. Again, let me answer your question. There is no case that directly says it must be in front of you to reserve it. It's logic that dictates that. If you have a compulsory counterclaim and you don't bring it and you go to a jury trial, the judge at the end of the jury trial can't throw in, oh, by the way, I reserve your compulsory counterclaim. How? You didn't have jurisdiction over it. It's not before you. You cannot possibly reserve something as a court when you don't even have jurisdiction over it in the first place. So I think logic dictates that result. I think that result is also dictated by Hanna. And let me say that in Hanna, it's absolutely true that I could find, and I don't know what the administrative law judge's order said, but at least the Industrial Claims Appeals Office and the Court of Appeals, there was no discussion of a reservation clause. There was no discussion of that. However, Hannah does mention, and the language it says is that the judge must expressly reserve the issue of future medical benefits. In order to keep the case open, it must expressly reserve the issue of future medical benefits. That's the language in Hannah. And so I think that Hannah does, by saying the judge must expressly reserve the issue of future medical benefits, it excludes the possibility that you could redo it with some boilerplate language, especially when the issue wasn't before you. Yes?
According to the clerk, you have 5 minutes left. I'm just passing it on.
So to answer your question, first, I think logic dictates you cannot reserve something of which you have no jurisdiction. And second of all, I think Hannah's expressed language prevents it.
How did paragraph 12 get into Judge Haar's order?
That's a good question.
That's why I asked it.
In 70% of all cases, if you go to the Office of Administrative Court's website, in 70% of all cases, that exact language is there. Did he stick it in there? Did his secretary stick it in there? Did a paralegal stick it in there? I have no way of knowing that, since I did not generate that order. All I can tell you is that in the vast majority of workers' compensation, it's just stuck in there at the end of every order.
I think my rule of construction is that we're to give effect to all the words, and whether it's contracts or orders or the like. Is there any basis for us to simply say it was meaningless and we can disregard it as mere surplusage?
I think there is here, because as a practical matter, there are many circumstances, by the way, don't get me wrong. I could give you a number of examples where it would make logical sense, where the parties have raised issues, where an administrative law judge would absolutely want to reserve issues. So don't get me wrong in saying it's never a tool for an ALJ to use. That's not what I'm saying. They use it all the time where issues have raised, and for a variety of reasons, they choose to reserve it. So that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying in this case, it's meaningless, because in this case, the issue was never in front of him, and he can't reserve something that's not before him and he didn't have jurisdiction over.
So I want to make sure, I think I understand the argument you're making about Hannah. I think you're saying, and correct me if I have this wrong, that to be expressly reserved, the ALJ had to mention medical benefits. I think you said Hannah expressly says that. True?
It does, yes, Your Honor.
Right. Could you show me where it says that? I don't know if you have it in front of you, because what I read, it says, unless an ALJ's award of benefits expressly reserves other issues for future determination, the award closes the claim and requires the parties to satisfy the reopening requirements. I don't see anywhere in Hannah, and I'm willing to be educated here, where it says the court has to specify which issues. Now, that may well be a good practice, but I don't see where you're looking at in Hannah where it says the court has to specify which issues.
I'm looking under Head Note 11, which is...
let's look at the text.
It would be at page 866 under Head Note 11. However, the first ALJ's order did not contain any clause that reserved the issue of medical benefits. Thus, the first ALJ's order awarded permanent disability, but effectively denied all further benefits because it did not reserve any issues. So, you know, I'm reading this is that because the ALJ's order awarded permanent disability benefits, but did not reserve the issue of medical benefits. That's what it says. And then, again, I'm looking under Head Note 9 and 10. Thus, unless an ALJ's award of benefits expressly reserves other issues for future determination, the award closes the claim and requires the party to reopen. So the way I read this again is that it must be an express reservation of future medical care.
Express could be, I expressly reserve other issues, or I expressly reserve the other issue of X. I suppose it could be either way. You suggest it's the second.
I do suggest that based on the case law. And I realize I'm running out of time, but let me add one thing here that's discussed extensively in Milko. And that is prior to Grover in 1988, the default in workers' compensation was that when a claimant reached maximum medical improvement, their right to medical benefits terminated. That's it. Under the statute, the injured worker is entitled to treatment only to cure and relieve the effects of his injury. When you reached MMI, you were cured and relieved. No more medical. That's why Grover established that you could have medical benefits after maximum medical improvement, but only if you showed the need when permanent disability was being determined. That's what Milko says, that's what Grover says, and that's what Hannah says. Hannah just goes a step further and said, if you don't do it, it's waived. It's waived. They use the waiver language as opposed to the language of the prior cases saying you must do it at this time. So the default in workers' compensation is if you do not raise it, it's waived. And therefore, it makes sense in this context to interpret Hannah that way. If you do not expressly raise it to the judge and he doesn't reserve it, it's waived. Well, you didn't even raise it in the first place. It has to be waived. So whatever remaining time, Your Honor, I would save for rebuttal.
I'm not sure you have any time. Was time expired?
It is.
Yes, okay.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Thanks for bearing with us on the clock. I apologize for that.
Yeah, it is, Your Honor.
This is an unusual case.
Counselor, are you Mr. Connell? Or yes, Connell. Could you pronounce your name?
Connell.
Connell, I apologize.
And I can tell you that Don Cordova sent me over to do two work comp hearings the first week I was a lawyer in 1983, and I've done them since. I haven't had this situation come up during that time. It's very unusual in the sense that the authorized treating physician said that Mr. Lassiter should have treatment after the date of MMI. They filed for a dime. The dime doctor said he should have treatment after the date of MMI. What normally happens in a case is that the respondents file a final admission, and then on the final admission it says, what's your position on treatment after the date of maximum medical improvement? At that point, the claimant has the opportunity to say, I disagree because they said I don't get any, or I agree, or whatever the case may be. In this particular case, respondents filed for a dime because they didn't want to pay permanent disability. They filed for a hearing because they didn't want to pay permanent disability. And then on the day of the hearing, withdrew any contesting of the dime opinion of permanent disability. At no point was the claimant really ever given an opportunity to say, I don't agree, because the respondents never took a position.
And wouldn't the claimant have had the ability or claimant's counsel to raise it at the time of the hearing, say, notwithstanding they're changing their mind on the permanent partial disability benefits, we'd like to ask for an award of future medical benefits.
And that's true. But it wasn't a contested issue. The respondents never said they weren't going to pay for treatment after the date of maximum medical improvement because they never took a position on it. And so at the time of the response, whether or not he was entitled to treatment after the date of maximum medical improvement really wasn't contested. It wasn't an issue that the claimant even could think about, because the issue really was their need to overcome the dime and their desire to put the safety rule violation in play and hopefully not pay any permanent disability until they got the safety rule violation heard. So at the time of response to the application, it certainly could have been put on the response to application, but there was no issue at that point to be raised. Judge Haar,
they were contesting the dime's opinion.
They were contesting
the dime. And in your response to the application, you also listed as an issue overcoming the dime's opinion.
And that was their issue. That mirrored what they had put on their application.
So why wouldn't you also put on there the medical benefits if you thought that was going to be an issue before they withdrew it at the date of the hearing?
It's an unusual situation that I never had come up during the course of my practice. But at the point that we filed the response to application, right, respondents had never taken a position and said they weren't going to pay for treatment after the date of maximum medical improvement because they never filed a final admission or gotten to that point. At the point, I still believe that at the point that they withdrew their contesting of the dime, they should have filed a final admission. The statute is incomplete in the sense that it does say if you file an application for hearing to overcome the dime doctor, you have satisfied the statute and you don't have to file a final admission. It's one or the other. However,
an insurance company, and certainly a sneaky insurance company, if they want to, could file the application for hearing, could wait a month, and then withdraw it. And then they would have never taken a position on Grover Medicals.
But you could have insisted on it going forward, right? I mean, that's one reason you, in response, endorsed the same issue, to prevent them from unilaterally withdrawing that petition, as I understand it.
Yeah, you could. Yes, you could make them go forward on the issue, but no right-thinking claimant attorney is going to make them try to overcome your dime. I mean, you have a good dime. You don't want to subject your client to a hearing on the possibility of having his impairment rating lowered, and forcing them to go to hearing on the issue, because they can bring in any doctor that they want to say, we don't agree.
So are you saying then that once they withdrew their opposition to the dime, you assumed that they were therefore not opposing future medical benefits, that you reached that assumption?
I don't think assume would be the right word. It's my position that at the point that they withdrew their opposition to the dime, I felt they should have filed a final admission of liability for the dime doctor's impairment rating. By filing a final admission of liability, they would have been required to take a position on the issue of Grover Medicals.
But they didn't. And Grover says that the right to future medical benefits is waived if it's not requested at the time permanent disability is heard, as Mr. Thomas just told us repeatedly.
My position that permanent disability was never heard. At the point at which he withdrew his overcoming the dime issue, in my opinion, permanent disability was set at that point, and it was not a contested issue. The only issue for the hearing was whether or not a safety rule violation should have been imposed.
Doesn't there have to be a finding, though, by the ALJ that future medical benefits are awarded? It doesn't just happen out of the blue, does it?
Well, in the normal situation, and again, I find this case to be highly unusual, in the normal situation, the respondents have to take a position on that issue. In this case, they never took a position on it.
Is there anything in the record that would answer the question as to why the judge put the reservation in there? For example, whether there was any thought given to future medical benefits or anything else specifically?
No, but I think counsel's indication that some secretary threw it in or some paralegal threw it in is ridiculous. The judge here is the chief ALJ and was an experienced workers' compensation attorney before he was an ALJ. I don't think you can assume that because he put a reservation in there that it's just superfluous language. I think it's there for a reason.
And nothing you said at the hearing that caused that to be put in there. There's nothing in the transcript that says, Judge, we have to reach another issue down the road.
No.
Nothing like that.
No, there was not anything at the hearing that took place that would have caused him to put that in. But there were outstanding issues. I mean, Paraguay says you need some finality. I was the attorney in Paraguay. I argued this case on the defense side because UPS was my client. But in that case, the difference was that they just had no issues, and he just wanted to keep the case open so that he might, if an issue came up somewhere down the road, he could raise it. In this case, there really were issues that were still sitting there.
Can you, Mr. Connell, respond to Mr. Thomas's forceful argument that you couldn't reserve something that the judge didn't even know existed? It wasn't before him.
I don't think you can presume that the judge didn't know it existed.
And that, I think, my two colleagues were getting at. How do we know the judge? I mean, I floated at least a hypothetical to Mr. Okay. Thomas. Maybe the judge saw it in the dime. How does the judge know it's there? I mean, could you try any issue ever if the judge doesn't, says I reserve?
Well, let me please say then that if respondents felt that way, they could have requested that the language be taken out. They could have appealed the decision and said, we don't think this language should be in there because there's no other issues that are still sitting there. They could have asked the judge for a clarification of his ruling. This was a summary order, and unless the party requests a full findings of fact after the summary order, then the summary order becomes law. And so at that point, counsel had a perfect opportunity, if he saw that in there, to say, and he didn't think there was any other issue that should be out there, to say, I want a full findings of fact, and I would like the court to address why they put this in there. You know, we can't sit here now, 3 years later, when this poor homeless guy hasn't had any shoulder surgery or back surgery, and say, this is what the judge wanted to do at that time. And I can't help the court in terms of what he was thinking. But in my particular case, I think it's a dirty deal, and I think he should be entitled to his medical benefits.
Mr. Cannell, would you also respond, if you would, to Mr. Thomas's argument? I asked him about Hannah. Where does he see express reservation have to mention the medical benefits?
Yeah, I felt it was a generous reading of Hannah, because as I read it, it says the first ALJ's order did not contain any, he skipped the any clause part, and just went, did not contain an issue that expressly reserved medical benefits. It doesn't say that. It says, did not contain any clause that reserved the issue of medical benefits. Well, in this particular case, there is a clause that reserves the issue of medical benefits and any other issue that would have been outstanding. And so,
in this five minutes, Mr. Cannell. Okay.
In this very limited case, and it is a very limited issue, but it's an important issue, because if a claimant is not represented, you have an attorney that's been doing this 30 years and it's an unusual issue. A claimant that's not represented could not possibly know that he has to go out and say that he wants the issue of medical benefits heard for Grover's if the authorized treating physician says you should have treatment, maintenance treatment, and the dime doctor says you have maintenance treatment. When you read that in the record, you would assume, well, I guess that means that I should have maintenance treatment. This is a bigger case only in the sense that if it applies to everybody.
The ALJ entered his order, though. He didn't say anything about future medical benefits.
He did not.
So why didn't your client appeal the order then?
Well, because again, at that point, the issue of future medical benefits, in my mind, was not an issue. The authorized treating physician was indicating that that was proper, and what we were fighting about, if that, was the fact that the respondents were trying to overcome the impairment rating.
I mean, Norm, let's say it had been contested. You would then expect the ALJ's order to say, yes, we award future medical benefits, or no, they're denied. I mean, there has to be some mention here of whether there's going to be future medical benefits, doesn't there? And there's nothing in the order that mentions it.
That's correct. And because it was reserved, as soon as they didn't file a final admission of liability, and we went ahead and put the issue of Grover Medicals at hearing, and that's what got us here. But at that point, because they were denying it, I had to set it for hearing, and I had to request that a judge put that specifically in an order. But again, it wasn't a contested issue as far as we were concerned until the point at which they said that they weren't going to pay for treatment after the date of maximum medical improvement.
What's the effect of this, of a very general reservation like this? Does it prevent there from being finality as to issues that no one had ever mentioned?
For a couple reasons. Number one, you can't reopen a case after 6 years no matter what. So, you know, it's not, there's finality there. Number two, the respondents, even if all this goes my way, the respondents can still disagree with any recommendation made by the doctor as to reasonable, necessary, or related. So even if all this goes Mr. Lassiter's way, and the doctor says you need an x-ray for your back, they can still say we don't want to pay for it because it's not reasonable or not related. So this case, the finality is, even in the general sense in workers' compensation, they still have plenty of opportunity. And again, had the insurance company felt like that was such a big deal, then they could ask the judge to take it out or to find it.
Mr. Cannell, I want to make sure I understand your argument. I think I do. I think you're saying you've got two arguments on Hannah. One is Hannah didn't apply at all because you never actually tried the issue of permanent disability benefits. Is that true?
Correct.
And then even if it applied, you got the reservation, I think is your position?
It is certainly distinguishable because it expressly states what our case says. And I don't have anything further, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you Nothing further from counsel, from my colleagues. With that, then, the case will stand submitted. We all want to thank both counsel for their excellent arguments. This has been very helpful. This is a very interesting case, and I think a difficult one. So we thank you for your briefs and arguments. The case will stand submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. And can I ask before we leave, this is for you, Mr. Thomas, is your client now known as HireQuest, or is it Trojan Labor, or which?
Trojan Labor is a DBA of HireQuest.
All right, so the correct legal name would be HireQuest?
DBA Trojan Labor.
Okay, thank you very much for that.